I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. The 436th session of the Maryland General Assembly is convening right now in Annapolis. It's going to be a busy 90 days. Already, lawmakers have filed one-third more bills than this time last year, and odds are it's going to be contentious. Republican Governor Hogan said anyone who disagrees with his tax relief plan shouldn't be in the legislature, and Democratic leaders of both houses vowed they would not be rubber stamps. In this hour, MarylandReporter.com's Barry Raskovar and Maryland nonprofit CEO Heather Iliff join us for a State of the State preview as we discuss where there's common ground and which issues will steal the headlines. The 2016 Maryland General Assembly on Midday after the news. Welcome to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast, and I am very glad that you are with us. At this hour, lawmakers are back in the oldest state capitol in the U.S., convening the 2016 session of the Maryland General Assembly in Annapolis. The issues they'll deal with in the coming 90 days are broad and important to citizens. They include tax cuts, paid sick leave, environmental and clean energy regulations, police reform, equal pay for women. The dynamic of the session is also complicated, as Republican Governor Larry Hogan seeks to shape state spending in ways that Democratic legislative leaders say are not in the state's long-term interest. Joining me in the studio to discuss the coming session is Barry Raskovar, columnist for MarylandReporter.com, blogger on the political Maryland.com. For years, he's been a regular contributor when Midday looks at politics. Barry Raskovar, welcome back to Midday.
Well, it's good to see you in the new year, Sheila.
So, opening thought, what do you expect from the session?
Well, I think the top three issues of this session will be the state budget. Almost everything that is going to become controversial will need money in one form or another. And because the governor and the legislature are pulling in different directions on budget issues, and because the state constitution doesn't allow the legislature to add money to the governor's budget, virtually every issue where there's going to be a shouting match will have monetary implications. And how it plays out is at anyone's guess at this point.
Okay, we're going to get back to that, obviously. But I also want to introduce Heather Iliff, president and CEO of Maryland Nonprofits. On Monday, the Maryland Nonprofits Organization presented its first State of Our State, Maryland's Quality of Life address. Heather Iliff, welcome to Midday.
Thank you, Sheila. Delighted to be here.
And let me ask you the same question. We're going to talk about the state, your State of the State address. But looking at the legislature, what are you looking for in this session?
I think Barry's right. The budget is going to be number one on the agenda. And we have proposals already from Governor Hogan to cut taxes, and Democrats are responding to that in various ways. Maryland Nonprofits is an association of organizations from across Maryland Nonprofits is an association of nonprofits from across the state, and we're one of the largest in the country doing work in communities around the state to make Maryland's quality of life better.
So you mentioned in particular just now tax cuts. And Barry, when you talk about budget, I'm assuming a legislative analyst would make a distinction probably between tax legislation and budget legislation. I assume you're putting all these things together, the money issues.
Well yes, because if indeed Larry Hogan puts $430 million of tax cuts into a legislative bill, that means there's $430 million coming out of the budget in some way. And Democrats may well want to do an overhaul of the governor's budget cut requests so that there are tax cuts, but they may be going in different directions. They may be much smaller, but they're going to have to negotiate that with a Republican governor. Which is why it makes things so interesting. The Democrats have such a stranglehold on the legislature that dealing with a very conservative Republican in the governor's mansion becomes a real seesaw battle.
Well, you when you say stranglehold on the legislature, that reminded me that I had read that we might see this very day a fight over the six bills that the governor vetoed after the last session, an attempt to override. What is the latest you've heard about whether the Democrats actually have the votes to override and whether they intended to do it?
They have the votes to override on many of those vetoed bills. One of the questions is whether they're going to put off the vote or do they want to send a strong message from day one of the legislative session to the governor. There are a couple of bills where there are some swing Democrats, some moderate Democrats, who may or may not decide to go along with the Democratic leadership because Hogan won their legislative districts in the last election with over 60% of the vote. So they may want to side with the governor on some of those vetoed bills to uphold the veto. But, you know, it's I think Speaker Mike Bush and Senate President Mike Miller really can control how far they want to go on those six vetoes. They could veto them all, or they could decide that maybe, for instance, on decriminalizing marijuana, or as opposed to marijuana paraphernalia, that maybe they should listen to Baltimore County State's Attorney Scott Schellenberger and not do it yet because it might interfere with law enforcement.
And not actually make that legislation law. In other words,
yes.
Leave it as vetoed.
Yes. So I mean, there are questions of that nature where there may not be the votes to override, but by now the Speaker and the Senate President know where they have the votes and where it could be close, and their decision is likely to be: do we do it right away when the session opens? Do we hold off for a couple of days or even weeks before we do it? And do we go after all six vetoes or just two or three?
Some of which we'll start to get an inkling of today. I mean, what would be the message if there is no attempt to override Governor Hogan's vetoes in this opening day? Well, would that show weakness on the Democrats' part?
No, I think it just postpones a showdown. I think some of those vetoed bills may come up for a vote today if they know they have the votes to override. Others, where it may be close, they could put it off for days or even weeks if they want to. They've done it in past years.
This is Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm here with Barry Raskovar, columnist for MarylandReporter.com, and with Heather Iliff, president and CEO of Maryland Nonprofits. I promise we're not going to spend the whole hour talking about vetoes. There's lots to talk about before the legislature, and I'm interested in what our listeners think ought to go on at the legislature, what you think about the heavy coverage in the last couple of days of the likelihood of a clash between Republican Governor Hogan and the Democratic leaders of the legislature. You can call us. Our local number is 410-662-8780, 410-662-8780. We also have a long-distance number. That's 866-661-9309. And you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We would love for you to be part of this conversation. So, Heather Iliff, Maryland Nonprofits, for the first time ever, put together a State of the State address, which you say is parallel to the kind of speech that we'll be getting from Governor Hogan, his view of the state of Maryland, which we'll get in a week or so. Why did you feel the need to do this? Why now?
Well, the state of Maryland is very high in many national rankings. So we're number one in household income, for example. We're number four in education. And in many ways, on the surface, Maryland's quality of life looks good on paper. But what we find when you look deeper is there are many priorities that we haven't attended to as a state. We have very high levels of poverty in Baltimore City, in the Lower Eastern Shore, in Western Maryland, and in fact, some of the deepest poverty in the nation in those areas. areas. We also have a lack of access to public transit, not just in Baltimore City, where the red line was cut, but in every county in the state. Our members, nonprofit organizations, are finding it a real barrier for people to achieve self-sufficiency because they can't get to work, they can't get their kids to child care.
You cite in your presentation that half of Marylanders who commute by car commute more than an hour. Is that round trip or is that one way?
That's one way, Sheila. So, yeah, 50% of Marylanders spend an hour each way in the car, and 50% of Maryland's transit commuters spend more than 90 minutes each way. And if you think about what that means for a family, that's taking away time to make a nutritional dinner for your family, taking away time to help with the homework, as well as, you know, just your own health, being able to exercise and pay attention to your mental health, not to mention recreation. So it has a very big impact on everyone's quality of life.
So we're accustomed to a state of the state coming from a chief executive to be the philosophical underpinning of a legislative platform of proposals. Is that true of your state of the state? Are there particular policy recommendations you're making to the legislature?
Yes, we wanted to provide a state of the state that gives an idea from the community perspective what's important. And we are a nonpartisan organization, as most nonprofits are. And so we wanted to give a clear-eyed view of what the data shows, as well as some real-life examples of how we can make Maryland a better state if we look at what we call a triple bottom line, looking at the economy, the community, and the environment in decisions that are made. So when we look at this upcoming legislative session, the budget is really a way to communicate the state's values and the state's priorities. And sometimes people think of the whole purpose of the budget as balancing the budget. And what we're trying to really say is the budget is there to create the necessary services and programs that are required in our communities so that people can live the lives that they deserve.
Well, let me pick up on one of the points that Barry Raskovar shared with us, which is the idea that if there is going to be significant tax relief, Democrats, at least in the legislature, and I take your point that Maryland Nonprofits is not a partisan group, but the argument that's coming that we're hearing already starting to come back from Democrats is there won't be enough. If revenue is cut significantly, there won't be enough resources to deal with the state's needs. So what does Maryland Nonprofits as an organization, as an umbrella organization, do about how do you respond to that?
So there are some aspects of the tax proposal that really show that the governor is paying attention to issues of equity and the geographic regions of the state that I mentioned that are suffering, Baltimore, Lower Eastern Shore, and Western Maryland. So those areas do need attention. I think the big questions are, how are you going to pay for it? So in what was announced around the tax cuts, there were really no specifics in how that would be paid for. We're very supportive, for example, of the idea of the earned income tax credit, which was, I think, pretty much the smallest aspect of the governor's proposal. That's a really good way to build to build self-sufficiency in low-income households, and it's been a proven program. I think some of the other proposals may not be quite as proven, and some states have tried some of these things without significant results, so that we need to look at that carefully.
We've got lots more to talk about here, but we're going to take a short break here. We're looking ahead to the legislative session getting underway right now in Annapolis and to the governor's State of the State message and his budget scheduled for next week. Our guests are Barry Raskovar, columnist for MarylandReporter.com, blogger on PoliticalMaryland.com, and Heather Iliff, president and CEO of Maryland Nonprofits. And you can join the conversation. What issue do you most want to see the legislature take up? What do you think of the way the governor and legislative leaders are dealing with each other? Give us a call. Our local number is 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about Maryland politics and policy this hour, particularly the General Assembly session getting underway right now. With me in the studio is Heather Iliff, President and CEO of Maryland Nonprofits. On Monday, she presented Maryland Nonprofits' first State of Our State, Maryland's Quality of Life address. And also with us is Barry Raskovar, columnist for MarylandReporter.com, blogger on PoliticalMaryland.com, to whom we regularly turn for political insight on Midday. Governor Hogan, as governors have been doing now for, I think, 13 years, sat down with Mark Steiner for an interview on WEAA. And this is one point that Governor Hogan made on the Steiner interview.
You know, we've maxed out the credit cards. We can't borrow more money. Voters of Maryland obviously don't want more taxes after 40 tax increases in a row. So we tried to restrain the growth of spending, but we did not cut education. Not true.
That was Governor Hogan speaking this morning to Mark Steiner on WEAA. Of course, it's a controversial claim that the governor makes, that he did not cut education spending. Baltimore officials think he did cut their spending.
It's political sloganeering. The governor is mandated by law to fund public education to a certain percentage. And there's nothing that this governor or any other governor can do about it. They have to put that money in their budget. So to make the claim that we didn't cut education, well, he couldn't cut education. One of the ironies of the fight in the legislature last year over the additional money, the $68 million that had been allocated in prior years.
This was the extra money to compensate for higher costs
in
certain
counties
areas.
In Baltimore City.
Geographic
it's index. Mm-hmm. And it's 11 counties, basically the larger jurisdictions that have higher costs. So this was designed to offset the higher costs of schooling kids. $68 million. Hogan refused to put it in his budget. Legislators fought him on that. In the end, Hogan stood firm and refused to cut that money, to put that money in the budget. As a result, the legislature turned around and said, well, in future years, Governor, we're going to mandate that you put this money in the budget. So the irony is that the $68 million that Hogan didn't put in last year, he has to put in for the next budget. He has no choice.
But now he is talking about, he's been talking quite a bit in the last few days about getting rid of mandates or somehow trimming those mandates.
Well, reform. Yes, this is a Republican favorite. The problem is that the mandates he's talking about deal with social programs for the poor. It deals with health programs, primarily for the poor, and it deals with education. He wants the ability to ratchet down spending in these areas as he sees fit. And quite frankly, it's a non-starter in the legislature. Senate President Mike Miller already said it's dead in the water.
I think one of his phrases was cold day in hell.
Yes.
Was one of his phrases to other Democrats.
Yes, he likes to be colorful. But the votes are not there to cut back on programs that affect constituencies of legislators in the Democratic Party. It plays well for Hogan's followers. It sounds good. It sounds sensible, but when you start translating it into dollars, it means that a lot of programs get cut back at the governor's whim, and that is what legislators don't want. The way it's set up in the state constitution is that the governor proposes a budget and the legislature gets to cut back the budget. Hogan wants to take the power away from the legislature to a degree, by eliminating these mandates so that he would have even more influence on the budget. And no legislature is going to sit there and allow a governor to do that. Because
so you're saying even if it were not, that it isn't as much, or it's perhaps not as much a partisan fight as prerogatives of the legislature versus prerogatives of the executive?
Well, it will be a partisan fight. You will not see any Republicans siding with the Democrats in the legislature on this. However, it really does boil down to, is the state legislature's leaders going to allow the governor more power in formulating the budget, or is the legislature going to stand up as a co-equal branch of government? And you can't do that when you're giving away power. So I think this is an issue that you'll hear a lot about, but at the end of the day, after 90 days in session, the legislature will not give Hogan any lessening of mandates.
Heather, let me turn to you on this, because obviously the kind of spending that Barry's talking about is important to many of you of the nonprofits that make up your organization. So how do you approach this issue with all of the, I forget how many members you have.
Right.
It's a huge
yes.
number of
1,200 members across the state of Maryland. And many of them provide services like mental health services, substance abuse treatment. They're in educational programs, arts programs, humanities. And those kinds of things do tend to be on the chopping block when times are tight, or like during the recession. But this year, it's not so tight. So this is the year that the first time in 10 years where we actually are going into the session with a forecast of a balance possibility. And in some ways, putting tax cuts on the table puts the cart before the horse in terms of looking at what are your overall priorities that you need to fund. So one example we can give you is in the mental health area. Over the past 18 years, there have been about 13% increase in the rates that mental health agencies receive from the government. And at the same time, the inflation index in the health field has been more than 80%. So it's getting very, very difficult for these agencies to even pay the minimum wage, much less a living wage, to people who are caring for our most vulnerable populations.
That's Heather Iliff, President and CEO of Maryland Nonprofits, here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Barry Raskovar of MarylandReporter.com, a columnist for MarylandReporter.com and a blogger on PoliticalMaryland.com, is here, too. We're talking about politics and policy in Maryland. And I ask listeners what you'd like to see the legislature take up, and what you think of the way the legislature and the governor are dealing with each other. You can call us. 410-662-8780 is our local number. Our email address is midday@wypr.org. We also have a long distance line, 866-661-9309. And Sam took me up on my question and is calling us from Baltimore with what he'd like to see the legislature do. Sam, welcome to Midday.
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
At the start, I'm not a huge fan of Hogan, but one of the things that he has proposed that I really hope the legislature gets on board with is his call for redistricting reform. And we saw that last night in the State of the Union address, where President Obama called for redistricting reform. So hopefully the legislature and Governor Hogan can work together, because even though, you know, I'm perfectly fine with having a largely Democratic congressional delegation going to Washington, I think the way in which we've drawn the districts is pretty despicable.
Thanks for your call, Sam. Barry, let me turn to you. I see a smile edges of your mouth when you think of the governor and the Democratic legislature working together on redistricting.
While I am firmly convinced that absolutely nothing will happen on changing the redistricting process, I agree with Sam that the current districts are so contorted that they make no rational sense whatsoever, except to ensure that the incumbents get reelected time after time after time. And it's just not fair. Most people cannot even tell you who his or her congressman is, because the districts just zig and zag all over the state. Congressman John Sarbanes' district in particular has been identified as one of the most ludicrous congressional districts in the nation, and with good reason. Probably what will come out of this is that the next time the redistricting maps are drawn after the next census comes out, that Democrats in the state legislature will try to rationalize the districts a little more, make them more compact. But I do not see any, a grand agreement between Larry Hogan and the Democrats in the legislature on this, because it would mean for Democrats, it may well mean losing seats in the legislature, and they're not about to do that willingly.
Heather, let me come back to a phrase that you used a few minutes ago that's sort of a theme of your State of the State presentation, the quality of life presentation. You talk about the triple bottom line, a financial bottom line, an environmental bottom line.
And community.
And a community bottom line. It's hard to think about three bottom lines. Tell me how you think that actually functions.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, so when we are looking at how well the state is doing, we're often just looking at one measure. For example, gross state product tells you how the total of goods and services provided across the state. But it doesn't really tell you the quality of how that affects people's lives. And we need to look at more measures, including the environment and community. And I'll give you an example. So in the Lower Eastern Shore, one of these areas that has very high unemployment, their biggest industry, the poultry industry, is so important. It's the lifeblood of that community and that economy. But at the same time, it produces a great amount of air pollution in terms of volatile organic compounds, ammonia, and dust in the air. And they have the state's highest asthma rates in that area, emergency department visits due to asthma. And so that's an example of just looking at one bottom line, the economic bottom line of the jobs, without looking at the environment and the community at the same time. And, we want to preserve our agricultural base. We want to preserve our job bases in Maryland. But there are other ways that we can create jobs and revitalize communities that look at all three of those. And we have some examples, if you'd like, I could share of how communities are doing that.
Give me one, yeah.
So staying on the Eastern Shore, for example, in Easton, Maryland, the Eastern Shore Land Conservancy has created a conservation building where you have five conservation organizations housed in one place in one of the poorest parts of the town, and they're connecting the community with parks and trails and housing as well to revitalize the town while also improving the environment. They're doing the same thing in Cambridge, where they're revitalizing a World War II era packing plant that will distribute goods from local farmers and create jobs. And they're going to be good jobs that are good for the environment and good for the community.
Well, I'll tell you what went through my mind as I read some of the examples in your State of the State presentation. You're really striking a very different note than we tend to hear as a legislature starts, which is because most of what we focus on is all about trade-offs. And, if somebody gets this, somebody else won't get this. And you seem to be saying, no, if we do things that make sense for the community, if we do things that make sense for the environment, it's going to be good for business, too. It's going to be good for jobs. That seems a little too kumbaya to me to be confident in.
I think a lot of times, people do look at things as black and white, like there's not a win-win opportunity. And there really are many ways that we can do all three and move Maryland forward at the same time.
So give me an example then of something you're going to be proposing to the legislature that you will argue is that kind of win-win.
In terms of for the legislature, I think investing in projects at the local level and ensuring that nonprofits' budgets don't get cut is a really important way, so that nonprofits employ one in ten employees in the entire state. We're a huge part of the economy, and those tend to be good jobs, jobs that have opportunities for advancement and invest in their communities.
Barry, do you have any reaction to this?
Well, I think there are areas where compromise, middle ground can be found between the governor and the legislature. And many of these areas have to do with projects that would help communities all over the state, poorer communities. One in particular, I think, is this tax cut proposal from Governor Hogan on manufacturing. If a manufacturer wants to come in and locate a plant on the Lower Eastern Shore in far western Maryland or in Baltimore City, he's proposing that the state's corporate tax basically be eliminated for that company for a decade, which is a pretty good enticement, I would think, for a company to locate in these areas. And these are the areas that have chronic low unemployment and have had for decades. It could give an enormous boost to say, communities out in Cumberland or out in Oakland, Maryland, or on the Lower Shore in Salisbury, or you know, in Baltimore City, in some of the impoverished areas. If they come in and know that they're getting a corporate tax write-off, basically, plus some local incentives, that could be enough to draw in these companies. And I think there well could be agreement between liberal Democrats and conservative Republicans on this, that this is a wise investment.
Let me pull Gino into the conversation. Gino was calling us, I think, with a comment on just that point. Gino in Baltimore, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thank you, and thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Yes, I actually was calling to comment to help frame this conversation and up. In a way that Mr. Raskovar just kind of went to my point. I wouldn't be so fast to judge the governor going into this session as of having any sort of naivete or political tone deafness on what he can and cannot accomplish in the General Assembly. Now, I own a small business in Baltimore City, very active in local Democratic politics. If you speak to any local legislator, they'll tell you the number one thing this city needs right now is jobs for people with a high school education or less. And I think the governor's proposal, got to remember, he was elected on a platform of reducing taxes, not increasing spending. But I think these proposals going into the session with the manufacturing proposal that Mr. Raskovar just spoke about very clearly sets the stage for some rather real political horse trading to begin between Baltimore City liberals and rural conservatives. And I think it's actually a very astute political move that could help our city. And secondly, with all due respect to your other guest, I don't believe any legislator in the state is going to tell you that by increasing work opportunities, jobs in the nonprofit community is where we need to go. We need to increase the manufacturing base in the state, get some blue-collar jobs going again, and incentivize through smart tax cuts in that area. Increasing the nonprofit job sector is not where we need to hit.
Gino, I appreciate your calling. Heather, I'll give you a chance to respond, and then you, Barry.
Yes, so I'll share another example from a nonprofit perspective in the Prince George's and Montgomery County area. Nonprofit organizations are actually some of the biggest promoters of entrepreneurship in Maryland. So nonprofits provide training, education, and support for individuals who want to start businesses. And that's not charity. That's not just, you know, giving people a fish for a day, but it's really teaching them how to fish and feeding for a lifetime.
We need to take a break here. Gino, I appreciate your calling. Barry, is there something you'd like to respond to Gino's comment?
Well, very quickly. I just think that there could be a role reversal that we're going to see in Annapolis in the next 3 months. You have a Republican who usually tries to be very conservative as far as doling out money, government money, taxpayer money. And you have a liberal legislature which traditionally likes to spend a lot of money. But this time around, it's the legislature which is going to have to look at the governor's tax cuts and determine whether or not it's affordable going forward. Or are we just setting ourselves up for a real bad tumble and a billion-dollar deficit in another year or two? So actually, It's the Republican governor who's the liberal on this issue by proposing the tax cuts. And the conservative faction in this debate is going to be the Democratic legislature, which has to determine, is there money to pay for this tax cut, not only this year, but 5 or 10 years down the road.
Interesting thought. And, Gino, I appreciate your putting your insights into this conversation. We're going to take another break here. Our guests are Barry Raskovar, columnist for MarylandReporter.com, blogger on PoliticalMaryland.com, and Heather Iliff, president and CEO of Maryland Nonprofits. If you have a question for either of them or a comment that you'd like to make about the legislature and its relations with the governor, give us a call, 410-662-8780, or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. We are talking about the legislature and nonprofits. We're talking about tax cuts. We're talking about all kinds of issues that will come before the legislature. With me in the studio is Heather Iliff, president and CEO of Maryland Nonprofits, and Barry Raskovar, columnist for MarylandReporter.com, blogger on PoliticalMaryland.com. And we're interested in you being part of this conversation. We have a few callers holding, but there's room for more. Give us a call, 410-662-8780, or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Ellen is calling us from Baltimore. Ellen, welcome to Midday.
Yeah, hi. Hi, everybody. Listen, I have a process question. When the governor submits a budget, what happens if can people in the legislature, either house, make amendments to that budget that don't have budgetary implications as far as spending goes, but say how the direction of money is limited or can be spent or something like that? And what is the process by which that happens?
I think Barry Raskovar is the perfect person to answer that. Thank you. Thank you for the question, Ellen.
Yes, the answer is absolutely the legislature can dictate how the money is going to be spent. They often do that in a budget reconciliation bill. They also put language within the documents that accompany the budget indicating how the legislature wants certain monies to be spent.
And is that language binding?
Well, that's a question that the courts have not yet been asked to resolve.
Really?
Yes. As you know, governors and legislators have usually found a way to accommodate one another without taking this issue to court. But you know, it could be that if we get into a nasty back and forth, the legislature may well put some instructions into the budget documents that Governor Hogan resists for a lot of philosophical reasons and decides to take the matter to court. There were some times when Bob Ehrlich was governor, another Republican, where I think they came pretty close to seeing how the courts would decide on the legislature possibly going too far in trying to control how the executive manages state government.
But essentially, to continue responding to Ellen's question about the process, all the legislature can do in terms of money is cut.
Correct.
Is cut.
Correct.
For this year, for the coming year.
So what happens, and we've talked about this a lot in this hour, is that you end up negotiating between, in this case, a Republican and a governor and the legislative leaders. Hogan has proposed something. The Democratic legislators don't like the proposal, so they end up possibly cutting another program that Hogan wants, and then they sit down and they figure out where's the middle ground on this. And, you know, it's not a bad process because you end up with both sides getting something.
Yes, Sheila, there's another process question that's one of our legislative priorities that you can find on our website at www.marylandnonprofits.org. And that is, after the budget is passed and after the legislative session is over, the governor has the option to cut any line item by as much as 25% and taking that only to the Board of Public Works for approval.
The Board of Public Works is made up of the governor, the controller, Peter Francio, and the treasurer, Nancy Kopp.
Correct. And at present, there's no involvement of the legislature. There's no public notice requirement of those cuts. And one of our legislative priorities is to get at least a 10-day waiting period between the governor's proposal for cuts and the decision on the Board of Public Works so people can scrutinize it and the public can comment on it before the decision is made.
So you're envisioning there would be a specified comment period for people to send the reactions or send a comment to the Board of Public Works.
Yes.
Because it would still be in their power to do it. You just want them to have to listen.
Exactly. It's a matter of governmental transparency and accountability.
Barry Rascovar, when you hear that proposal from Maryland Nonprofits, do you think and of course the Board of Public Works is at this point made up of a Republican and two Democrats, would the governor look at this as an erosion of his prerogatives to have to hear those comments as opposed to acting quickly?
Possibly not. It makes sense to have a full airing of a discussion when you're making some drastic cutbacks in spending, and usually this only takes place in recessionary times. When there is a sudden emergency where the governor has to make a reduction because something has occurred and there's been a dramatic drop, say, in the income tax revenue coming in, and we're short $500 million. So it doesn't hurt to allow the citizens time to respond. Right now, the governor can pretty much just quietly go to the Board of Public Works and not make a public announcement until the day of the decision when the vote's going to take place. And that is not the type of transparent government I would think that Hogan or a lot of legislators would want.
Heather Iliff, what are some of the other proposals that Maryland Nonprofits are taking to the legislature, your other priorities?
Yes. Yeah, so along those same lines, Maryland Nonprofits and a coalition of other organizations, open government organizations across the state, are advocating for improvements in the open meetings laws. And last year, we were very pleased to see the Maryland Public Information Act updated, and we'd like to see that implemented properly and continue to be strengthened.
One issue that I read is going to come up again is what some people call assisted suicide and some people call right to die. And I jotted down, but I don't have right in front of me, the new language for it in this year's version. Basically, a law that would allow people to decide and to have the power to terminate their life. That's something that I presume you've got nonprofits on multiple sides of that issue. So I presume that's not something Maryland Nonprofits has a position on.
Yes, we don't have a position on that issue.
Yeah. And where do you see that going, Barry? Do you
it's a very, very close call as to what, if anything, legislators are going to do on this. It's an emotional issue.
Very emotional.
And there are a lot of people who feel very strongly that, you shouldn't play God in instances like that. There are others who think it's the humane thing to do. And we haven't heard from the governor whether he'd even sign such a law. It's got a long way to go, 90 days, and to get out of committee, to get votes on the House and the Senate floors, and it will depend in large measure on the precise wording of the document. I think the chances are that it may end up where it has been for a number of years, which is back under study by the legislature this summer.
Shifting gears here, we got an email from Nick in Baltimore who says, expanding on Barry's point, how is the governor going to pay for these tax cuts? I certainly hope it's not going to be by cutting spending in mental health, education, and other kinds of social spending. I think, Heather, you already addressed that, and that sort of is the crux of the going to be the crux of the argument, right?
Yeah, Governor Hogan is probably the most secretive governor we've had in at least 40 years. He doesn't release much in the way of details. He rather paints the big picture for people. Saying I'm going to have tax cuts, $430 million in these areas. But as far as the specifics, we won't know until the budget is released how he's going to pay for it and whether this is something that is not affordable 2 or 3 years out, which would mean that the governor would have to cut some of these social programs even further next year and the year after that. Those are the types of questions the legislators are going to be asking, because it may not make sense to have these tax cuts if you can't pay for them down the road.
Barry, can you just quickly, we have just a few minutes left, give us an idea of some other areas where you think there will be common ground between the Democratic majority and the Republican governor. Police reform, there's just been a proposal for 22 different reforms in
Well, the police reform is one area that I think they will find common ground. Another area is eliminating some of the laws that put minor drug offenders in prison, in jails.
This is part of this whole movement they call justice reinvestment.
Now, from the Republican governor's standpoint, it means he can reduce spending dramatically on prisons.
They've estimated $250 million over 10 years?
Yes. 4 years, so it's really significant. But it also makes sense. But here's where the budgeting aspect comes into place again, which is that if you're going to be eliminating the prison sentences for minor drug offenses, then you need more programs out there.
Drug treatment
programs. Where's the money coming from? Will it be in the governor's budget next week? If it's not, then you have a whole new round of negotiations to persuade the governor to put that money in the budget for the drug treatment programs later on in the session.
I think you've both given us an idea of what some of the conversations are going to be like over the coming 90 days. And so I'm grateful to both of you, Heather Iliff, President and CEO of Maryland Nonprofits, and Barry Raskovar, columnist for MarylandReporter.com. Lunch for our guests here on Midday is provided by Ethel's Creole Kitchen, located in Mount Washington Village at 1615 Sulgrave Avenue. Ethel's features a lunch and dinner menu with gumbo, jambalaya, salads, sandwiches in the New Orleans style. More information at ethelscreolekitchen.com. And finally, thanks to our listeners. Join us tomorrow in Midday. We'll discuss what's behind big disparities in health between blacks and whites. Here and Now is up next. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great afternoon.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Connor Graham. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.